All right, let me join everybody else in saying welcome. Glad you're here. Happy Easter. I hope it's a great day for you. The weather didn't cooperate quite as well as we had hoped, but that's the way it goes, right? So this is really a wonderful day, probably of all the days in the Christian faith. This is the day on which everything hinges. Everything hinges on today. And here's the brute reality. If what happened on Easter Sunday, if Jesus really rose from the dead, not only does our faith as a Christian hinge on this day, but the entire human race hinges on this day. Every man, woman, and child on planet Earth that has ever been, somewhere in the 12 to 14 billion people that have ever lived, this day, it determines and hinges everything about it. So this is a pretty special day. But this is not just a day. It's kind of connected to an entire weekend that's pretty critical. Because on Good Friday, we're really defined. That particular day, Friday, was defined by regret and shame. And the fact that both the exposed and hidden things in our lives. Remember, we talked about Peter, and we're going to talk about Peter a little bit more today. But on that particular day, Peter denied Jesus three times. He did it around a charcoal fire, on the most part, in the house of Caiaphas. And he went to Caiaphas, who was the high priest, and three times in fairly rapid succession, he denies Jesus. And I have a feeling that on the very first time that he said it, he goes, "No, I don't know him. No, I'm not one of his disciples," that he thought, "I can't believe I just said that. I can't believe I just did that. I said I would never do that. I said I'd die for Jesus." And then all of a sudden, when simply a little girl asked me, "Are you one of his disciples?" he says, "Not me." Then some others asked him, "Are you one of his disciples?" And he said, "No." Again, he denied him a second time. I have a feeling Peter said, "I can't believe I said it again. I can't believe I did it again." And then a little while later, Malchus, who Peter had cut his ear off a little bit earlier, one of his relatives asked Jesus, "Didn't I see you in the garden?" Asked Peter, "Didn't I see you in the garden?" And he says, "No, not me. I wasn't there. I'm not with Jesus." I have a feeling all of a sudden for Peter, it turned not just to, "I can't believe I said it. I can't believe I said it again." Now all of a sudden he says, "That's who I am." Because it says that he left and he wept bitterly. That all of a sudden it had become who he is on the inside. This person had denied and done such incredibly horrible things. It's probably something we all can identify, that we can't believe that we've said what we've said in life. We can't believe we've done what we've done in life. And not only that, but we can't believe we said it again and did it again. And eventually all those things kind of add up and become defining for who we are as people. And I think that's why Sunday morning is so important. Because on Sunday morning, all of a sudden, we're going to go from regret and shame that it's exposed and hidden, but that regret and their shame can be transformed into hope and purpose. It gets transformed this particular day as we celebrate this into hope and purpose. And let me just kind of give you a thought about that, or just some context to that. Let me go to chapter 16 of Mark, okay? And I'm just going to read this kind of short version of Sunday morning, okay? And Mark, who is not one of the disciples, but is probably really an intimate companion with Peter along the way, writes this story. He's probably heard Peter say it 1,000 times. Peter had told this story so many times, Mark could write it down for himself, and he did, and he says this. Look at this, verse 1 of chapter 16. "When the Sabbath was passed, after the crucifixion, and after a day of lying in that grave, on a third day, when the Jews would say, 'For sure he's dead.'" You see, it takes 3 days to actually confirm that someone was dead to a Jewish mind in that day. And on that third day, it says, "When the Sabbath passed, there are these people, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome, who is Mary, Jesus' mother's sister." And so these are cousins. Salome brought spices so that they might go and anoint him. "And very early on the first day of the week, when the sun had risen, they went to the tomb. And they were saying to one another on the way, 'Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance to the tomb?'" A pretty rational thing to think, okay? Pretty reasonable, right? Then on verse 4, "And looking up, they saw that the stone had been rolled back. It was very large. It was huge. Probably more than 3,000 pounds, this rock that needed to be moved." Verse 5, "And entering the tomb, they saw a young man sitting on the right, dressed in a white robe, and they were alarmed. That's probably a reasonable thing to do, right? I'm like, well, it's going to scare you to death. You know, there's this person in there with this white robe, and it's a young guy, and he says to them, hey, don't be alarmed. You seek Jesus of Nazareth, who is crucified. He is risen. He's not here. See the place where they've laid him. And then you can almost see him sweeping his arms, saying, look at where they laid him. And the only thing that's still there are his grave clothes, just lying there, undisturbed. Even the piece that had been on his face had been folded and put in place. Wow. Look at this in verse 7. But go, and this is fabulous, but go, tell his disciples and Peter, circle it, and Peter. If you were Peter and you had denied the Lord three times, and it says in that, in Luke, that when after he denied him a third time that Jesus turned and he looked at Peter, and Peter laughed and he wept bitterly. Wouldn't you want the Lord to say, hey, go tell my disciples and make sure you tell Peter? Because Peter needed something, because he was such a strong, vivacious man, and he had denied the Lord so powerfully. The shame, the regret that he felt had to be incredibly deep. He disappeared. He didn't go to Jesus' crucifixion. He didn't show up. He was somewhere hiding out, or maybe he was somewhere, left town, somewhere he didn't show up. But he says, I want you to go and tell the disciples, but I want you to tell Peter that he is going before you to Galilee, and you will see him, and there you will see him, just as he told you. Because before Jesus said, I'll meet you in Galilee, they didn't really understand what it meant. But he says, go to Galilee, because I'll see you there. And then it says they went out and fled from the tomb, for trembling and astonishment had seized them. I think that's incredibly reasonable, right? I mean, if all this happened, you'd be incredibly scared, and you would be amazingly astonished all at one time, mixed together, and you wouldn't really know how to what to do with it. You would be just all full of energy and not know what to do, right? And it goes on and it says, and it seized them, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. So they left that place, and they didn't talk to anybody on the way back. Eventually, we know they went and talked to the disciples, and they said, you guys, it's empty. The tomb is empty. And it says that James and Peter took off on a foot race for the tomb. And it says that John got there first because he's a young buck, and Peter is a little older. But John stopped at the door, and Peter goes rushing in like a wind to see what had happened. Peter, this strong man, is now going, I've got to see this, because he's risen from the dead. Wow. Now, let's jump over to John chapter 21. And I want to walk through this and kind of get a feel for it, because eventually they end up at the Sea of Tiberias, the Sea of Galilee, if you will. Just like Jesus had said, meet me there. So they went there. And here's what this morning, instead of just retelling the story of Easter, just kind of retelling it in some unique way, the issue here is, what is the implication? What's the implication? And I wonder if we could find the implication of the resurrection in the life of Peter. Because I think the life of Peter is something that we all can identify with. I can't believe I said what I said. I can't believe I did what I did. I can't believe I said it again and did it again. I can't believe it's now become who I am. And the grief and the regret and the shame and the pain is almost unimaginable. And I wonder if that's where we find this then. So look at this. After this, after all these things, and Jesus had appeared to the disciples twice in Jerusalem. And they left there, and this is probably a week to 2 weeks later, because they had to travel over 60 miles to get to Galilee. It took them several days. And when they got there after this, Jesus revealed himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. And he revealed himself in this way. Now listen to this. Simon Peter, there's seven of them, Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, that's James and John, and two others, they don't even name them, of his disciples were together. And Simon Peter said to them, they're there, and he says, I don't know, I'm going fishing. That's what he grew up doing. He knew how to fish. And instead of just sitting around doing nothing, he said, I'm going fishing. It seems so reasonable, right? And then he says, and they said to him, the other disciples, well, we'll go with you. That's what you do when you're with a fisherman, right? I've been with fishermen. I'm not a very good fisherman. But when they say, let's go fishing, I go, okay, I'll go with you. That's what we do. And then it says they went out and they got into the boat, but that night they caught nothing. Have you ever gone fishing and caught nothing? I've gone fishing and caught nothing. We used to go to Mexico a lot, and we go out deep sea fishing. And there was one particular day we went about 65 miles out. You couldn't see land for hours, you know. And we trolled all day. It was really, the waves were really rough. The fish were not biting. I felt totally beat up. I get seasick, so I had gotten sick, you know. And it was a horrible experience. We didn't catch a thing. We didn't even get a nibble all day long. It was like you come back and you just like feel like a rag. These guys had been out all night and they caught nothing. The last thing you want to do when you're ready to come in is do anything more. You're just like, okay, I'm done. I'm finished. You know, just pack me up. But look at this in verse 4. Just as day was breaking, because they fished all night, it says Jesus stood on the shore. And yet the disciples did not know it was Jesus. And Jesus said to them, he calls out, hey, children, interesting term for them. Children, do you have any fish? Now, they didn't feel like he was rubbing it in, but that's what we would have done had we not gotten fish. Hey, did you get any fish? No, you didn't get any. But they answered him, and they said, no, we didn't get anything. Verse 6, and he says to them, cast the net on the right side of the boat, and you will find some. Now, it doesn't comment on what they thought in their head, in their heart. You know, I don't know about you, but if someone would have said that to me, I'm like, yeah, shut up. You know, we've been fishing all night. It's not like we haven't thrown the net over the right side before. We've been working the right side and the left side and the front and the back, and we've been doing this all night. And now that the day is breaking, the fishing's going to get worse. Fishing's really good at night in the ocean like that, in a sea like that. So he says to them, hey, throw it over the right side. And so they cast it. And now they were not able to haul it in because of the quantity of fish. I'm sure they started thinking, whoa, what's happening? What's that all about? And beginning to think, oh my gosh, what's going on here? Look at this in verse 7. That disciple whom Jesus loved, this is usually the person we think that wrote the Gospel of John, who we think is John, who always refers to himself in this book as the one that Jesus loved. He never calls himself up by name. He just says, no, I'm just the one he loved. Not that he didn't love others, but he knew that he had been loved by Jesus. That's a powerful thought, isn't it? Wow. I hope that you can go home today and say, I'm the one that he loves. I'm the one he loves. I didn't deserve it, as Heather shared, and you didn't earn it. He gave it. That's what love's all about. You give it. Wow. Well, here's the one that Jesus loved, therefore said to Peter, Peter, it's the Lord. Now, you guys, watch this. Look at this. It's incredible. When Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he was stripped for work, which means as they were out there fishing, they took off all of their outer garments. They just are left with kind of a little gym trunks kind of a deal. And because it's hard work out there, and you just don't want to get it all wet, and so you put it aside. And so instead of, in their modesty of his culture, which I appreciate, he takes on his outer garment, and he puts it on. And then he threw himself. This Greek word for throw is balo. And balo is this incredibly energetic, semi-violent thing to do, to throw. And it means what he did is he put on his outer garment, he's like throwing it on, he's putting on the sash, and then he threw himself. He didn't get up on the edge of the boat and do a nice dive. You know, I mean, that's what we think. Okay, take a nice dive, get a start, get an underwater, do your dolphin kick, and come up and be ready to go. No, but here's what he says. And he's like, oh my gosh, it's the Lord. He throws on his outer garment, he puts on the sash, and he throws himself over the edge. That's what this word balo means. He's like, can't wait. He threw himself into the sea. That's amazing. And so Simon Peter, and he says, and he threw himself into it. That's incredible. And the other disciples came in the boat, dragging the full net of fish, for they were not far from the land, but about 100 yards off. Wow. Look at verse 9. When they got out on land, they saw a charcoal fire. You guys, let's not miss this. Only twice in the New Testament is this idea of a charcoal fire ever mentioned. The first one is in Caiaphas' house that we talked about, around which Jesus denied the Lord 3 times. I don't think it's any accident that Jesus built another charcoal fire. I think he knew the redemptive need of Peter. That around the first charcoal fire, Peter had done what was unthinkable and said what was unthinkable. And now there's another charcoal fire in place. And look at this. And fish are laid out on it and bread. The Lord had a meal ready. Now, I don't know where he got the fish. I don't know where he got the bread. It doesn't tell us in the scriptures. He may have gotten it at the local 7-Eleven. I don't know. Maybe he just snapped his fingers and they were there. I don't know. It doesn't tell. Jesus could do it any way he wants. All I know is he was prepared. And he was prepared in such a human way, wasn't he? A lot of you are going to go somewhere for dinner afterwards. It's a hospitable, kind, beautiful, relational thing to do. And here, Jesus has fish and bread ready for the guys. That just amazes me. Jesus said to them, and not only did I bring some, but you guys, bring some of the fish that you just caught too. That'd be great. Yeah, you've got, clean them, please. I mean, I'm sure he said, hey, clean them. But bring them on over, and we'll start cooking up those guys too. It's incredible. So Simon Peter went aboard and he hauled the net ashore full of large fish, 153 of them. That's a lot. And although there were so many, the net wasn't torn. God supplied in this beautiful way. Look at verse 12. Jesus said to them, this is so human. I love this. Come and have breakfast. Come and have breakfast, guys. He reaches people right where we're at in such a real way. You guys, if you were the Messiah, and you were on the shore, what would you do? I know I would have. I would have set up a big altar. I would have had this really big throne on top of it, and I would have sat in it if I were him. And I would have said, why don't you guys come in, dress, get dressed, will you? And now come and sit down and worship. That's what I would have done. Here he says, hey, you guys, come have breakfast. I've been cooking it for you. I've been anticipating you coming. I want you to know how much I love you. And he makes breakfast for them. Are you kidding? That's incredible. Now, none of the disciples dared to ask him, who are you? For they knew it was the Lord. They're not going to be so stupid, right? They're like, oh, man, okay, just be quiet. It says, verse 13, Jesus came and took the bread, and gave it to them, and so with the fish. He served them. Wow. Look at verse 14. Now this was the third time that Jesus had revealed to the disciples that Jesus had been revealed to the disciples after he was raised from the dead as a group. It's the third time he did it. But it's probably the most personal, right? He's sitting down having breakfast with them. It's amazing. Look at verse 15. And when they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter. Now you guys, let's just picture this for a second. It doesn't tell us if he took Simon Peter aside. It doesn't tell us that he did it in front of the disciples. We don't really know, and maybe it doesn't matter. But he goes to Simon Peter because there's this incredible need. You know what? All the other disciples knew what Peter had done. All of them except for John had run for the hills. But they knew that Peter not only followed, but he denied him three times. I'm sure he's feeling terrible about it. And I'm sure some of the other guys can't believe he said it and did it either. Though they had done their own, right? So Jesus says to Simon Peter, Simon, interesting, he doesn't call him Peter. He calls him Simon, his Hebrew name, son of John, and he asks him this incredible question. Do you love me more than these? Now, let's just stop for a second academically and ask, more than these, more than what? What does this refer to? And frankly, in the Greek, it doesn't give us a real great clue on what he's referring to. He could be saying, do you love me more than you love these guys? Or do you love me more than these guys love me? Or do you love me more than you love fish and the boat and the net and this life you used to have? Do you love me more than you love this? I have a feeling he's referring to all of that. But maybe especially, do you love me more than the life you might go back to? You could come back and fish the Sea of Galilee the rest of your life. But I got something else for you. Do you love me more than this? Do you love me more than all the things in your world? Now, let's circle love here, because what Simon is being asked by Jesus is, do you love me? The word here used here in Greek is agape. It's the beautiful, unconditional love. It's kind of the top love of all loves. But let's admit it here. What we have going on here is really an interpretation, because this conversation probably happened in Aramaic, and only one word for love in Aramaic that they would have used here. So the Apostle John, having heard this whole interaction, is now interpreting what was going on in this as he writes it in Greek, okay? And so what's happening is Jesus says to Simon, do you love me unconditionally with the highest and most incredible love? Do you love me, Peter? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love phileo. I have an affection for you. I have a brotherly love for you. No, Jesus, it probably isn't an unconditional love. You know that, Jesus. You know that I just denied you. You know that I'm a man of flesh. You know that I'm probably not the greatest lover in the world. Jesus, no, I didn't love you like that. But yes, do I love you? Yes, I love you. I have this affection for you. You're my brother. But I have fallen so terribly short. If you were Jesus, what I would have said, then get it together, will you? Knock it off, Jack. Though his name's not Jack. But knock it off. Love me better than that. But look at this, what Jesus says to him. Feed my lambs. I have people that are going to remain, and I'm going to go. But I need some people to feed them. Will you please feed them for me? Care for them? Love them? Will you do that for me? Feed my lambs. Wow. That'd be really strong, I think, if Jesus said that to you or to me, if I were Peter. But look at this. He says it again. Look at verse 16. And he said to him a second time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Do you agape me? Do you unconditionally love me? Do you love me with a huge, incredible love that's powerful, full of grace and truth? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I phileo you. You know I love you. Yes, you know it's not perfect. Yes, you know I fell short. But I love you. And once again, Jesus says to him, then tend my sheep. Be with them. This word tend basically means to be with them in the pasture. And when a bear comes, throw rocks at the bear. When a lion comes, take a stick and beat him away from my people. Tend, care for, protect my sheep. I'm giving that to you, Peter. And Peter can almost inside going, God, or Jesus, I don't even love you that great, though. He goes, yeah, I know, I know. I'll take you as you are. Remember Friday night I said, now don't go away with that list of sins and try to get good, because that's religion. He says, no, I'll take you like you are. I'll take you just like you are. Tend my sheep, Peter. Then look at this in verse 17. And he said to him a third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Interesting, Jesus changes the word here. Or at least John takes it, the word, and changes it. And what Jesus was intending, do you love me, phileo me? Do you have an affection for me and an honest love? Yes, I understand it falls short, but do you love me? And Peter was grieved. Almost takes you back to the time he denied Jesus. He was grieved because he said to him a third time, do you love me, phileo, again? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. You guys, let's just stop there for a second. Jesus, yes, you know me. You know everything about me. You called me over three years ago to follow you. You know that I can be this impetuous, kind of reactive kind of a guy. You know I'm enthusiastic. You know I'm loyal. You know everything about me. You know that I came and I said I would die for you, and I meant every word of it, and I failed miserably. I denied you three times in front of a little girl, in front of the servants, and in front of this guy who's a cousin of Malchus. And I totally denied you. There was no danger. John was there, and no one was arresting him. There was no real danger to me. I was just afraid. And I totally denied you. And I did. I said it once, I said it twice, and the third time, it's core to who I am as a person. My mess up, my screw up, all the things that I've ever done wrong, it's core to me as a person. And he grieved and he wept bitterly. Because you know everything about me. And you know that honestly, deep down, I love you, but not like I should. And not as much as you love me, but I love you. And then Jesus said to him, I'll take you just like you are. Feed my sheep. Care for my people. Wow. Then in verse 19, and after saying this, he said to Peter, follow me. Peter, I know that you're not perfect. I know that you're just a man. But I can do fabulous things if you'll follow me. It doesn't mean lead me. He doesn't say, now go live a great life. Suck it up, be a better man, do it out of the flesh. He goes, all you have to do is follow me. I'll show you the way. I'll teach you the way. I'll fill you with my spirit. All you have to do is follow me. I will show you life. Wow. Here's what I think is going on here. Let's just kind of wrap this up. The regret and the shame that we live with, both exposed and hidden, can be turned into hope and purpose by the redemptive and gracious work of Christ, who loved me and gave himself for me. He can live his life in us and through us. Okay? Here are the implications, I think, of this resurrection. They're profound and they're personal. The implications of this is, I think he's calling us to do this. He is calling us to throw ourselves into the sea of God's hope and purpose. I think he's saying, it's the Lord. And we put on our outer garment and we put on our sash and we throw ourselves into this hope and purpose that he brings because of a risen Christ. And it's what life is all about. It's what life is all about. Because at the end of the day, he says, follow him. To follow him. He is a risen Christ that we can follow and give our whole lives to. You know, we keep living our lives on one level, kind of going down the streets of our own design. But the unfortunate thing is it always comes to a dead end. And it usually gets messy and ugly. And we reach a place exactly like where Peter was, where he wept bitterly. Rather than saying, I'm giving it to you. You be the one I follow. I'm going to obey you. Because you are the one who not only died for every one of my sins, but you are one who rose from the dead and defeated death and has prepared a place for me. Jesus eventually would say, I came to prepare a place for you, and I'm going to finish it off. And I will welcome you to that place. And we are going to have a party that's called the Wedding Feast of the Lamb. Well, it will be like you can't believe. You've been to parties here? You ain't seen nothing until he throws that one. And that's where he's called us. And so for many of you, you've already made that decision. And for others, you've probably been wrestling with that decision. And maybe today is the day that you say, I'm giving it to you. I'm giving my heart to you. Do I love you fully, Jesus? Not like I should. But you can do this in me because I'm going to follow you with my whole life. Maybe today for you, that's the first time you're ever going to do that. I pray that God would draw you close to him and strengthen you. So we're going to finish by worshiping the Lord, but let me just pray for us as the band comes up. Let's pray together. Father, we recognize that this is a day like no other day. We celebrate what happened 2,000 years ago. But Father, it happens every year. It happens every day that you are available to give us new life, to take our regret and our shame and to turn it into hope and into purpose, just like you did in Peter's life. Each one of us needs that. And your call for us is to follow you. So if you're sitting here this morning, you've never made that decision. It's pretty simple. It's just surrendering your life to him. Put it in your own words. Say it the way your heart says it. If you already know him, today's the day to kind of re-up and to say, I want to follow you. And Father, we recognize that when we follow ourselves, life is a mess. It's chaos. It's crazy. When we follow you, it doesn't mean that life gets all easy. But it does give us hope and it gives us purpose. And it's to that that we desperately need you. And that we tell you that we love you. But we love you because you first loved us.